Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Brett. Brett First. Brett is a fellow adoptee, and he's a therapist, and he does a lot of work within the addiction space. So I'm really fascinated to explore this because it's not an area I know anything about. So I'm welcome to the show, Brett. Lovely to see you,
man. Hey, yeah, thank you. I really appreciate your time and having me on. You know, I'm always excited to be able to kind of talk about this adoptee addiction change, you know, all that sort of stuff. Because it's not talked about nearly enough, in my opinion. So you know, I'm not by any means like the be all end all of this topic, but I do love being able to get it out there and get people talking about it. So I appreciate the platform to do that.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. So listeners, we were talking about, you know, what's going to be that. We had a conversation a few weeks back, Brett and I, we were talking about what's going to be the focus and what's going to be the title. And we looked at something called the cost of change. And we thought that's not kind of, it's not, direct enough. We looked at, you know, if this was a traditional self-help podcast, you know, we would be saying, we call it how to change. So this is, you know, you don't know how to change, we do, we're gonna tell you, and that kind of basically lying, often kind of like being falsehoods. And so we came up with this title of how we change. So it's going to be more of an exploration. We're going to look at it from this specific lens of addiction, but we're going to look at it through other stuff as well, because we don't want to make it a pure addiction special. Can you imagine that? Yeah. Tonight we've got an addiction special with Simon Ben. You know, it's not really my thing. So how we change. I think one of the things is people say we change slowly, don't we? sometimes that's not always the truth. That's not always the truth. So how we change is about the mechanism that happens, the insights that we have, the amount of time that it takes. What's your take on this, Brett? Let me open it up to you, because you're I'm just a guy who likes being coached and has learned a little bit about that. I'm not a therapist like yourself.
I mean, I think at the base level, it's important to kind of to understand that in human nature, there's often a very large gap between what I call like want and work. There's often a desire to change and an understanding to change and a logical understanding that, you know, there's things around you or in your life that you would like to change and need to change and, again, want to change. But the work required to do that is often daunting, and we don't know why. Because oftentimes the change that we want to make is going to make our lives easier and more positive and all that sort of stuff, right? So why wouldn't we make that change? Why wouldn't we put in the effort? A lot of it has to do, you know, with safety, right? Even if we are in, you know, this awful, terrible, miserable state or whatever it is, if we talk about like the far end of the spectrum, it's still familiar. It's still known. It's still something that, you know, we'd rather take the devil we know, because we know, take addiction, right? Addiction doesn't make logical sense. Why would you go out every day and use a drug and you know that it's bad for you and all that kind of stuff? But you do know how your day is going to go, more or less, within a certain number of factors, right? You're going to go out, you're going to use, you're going to feel crappy, and then you're going to feel better when you're high, and then you're going to feel crappy again, and then you're going to da-da-da-da-da, right? So everything's kind of contained in the bubble of being in your addiction. And that is familiar. It may not be happy or contentment or whatever, but it's safe, more or less, mentally, right? It doesn't ask anything of you. You've already lived that life. You know how to be that person. On the opposite end, to move forward, to stop doing that, to go to school, get a job, have a career, have a life, have a family, all those big, great, wonderful things, that can be scary as hell, because that is something that is unknown. So we often, and that's a big example, but as humans, we generally take the devil we know versus the devil we don't, even if, the other one is arguably and objectively and logically more positive and better. And there's a lot of theories as to why, but at the core of it, change is difficult for us because we can't predict the future. As much as we would like to, we don't know how things are going to go. So we'd rather stay in the thing that we know how it's already going versus the thing that we don't know how it's going to go. And that speaks to like our basic evolutionary need. That's your strongest drive, more than procreation or sex or anything like that. Your strongest drive is to stay alive. And so without lions and tigers and bears in our world anymore roaming around trying to kill us, and we have to fight for our food and all that kind of stuff, we translate it to safety of emotional things, safety and environmental things. And so we try and preserve that safety as much as possible, often to our own detriment. So that is one of the biggest reasons why change can be so difficult, is because we don't know what's going to happen if we change. We do know what's going to happen if we stay the same, even if it's bad, but we know what it is.
Yeah. So some people, the word that came to my mind really was as the opposite of safety was in this regard was curiosity. So I staying stuck, or there's kind of like the staying stuck and or the as the you know I'm gonna fight my stuckness. And then somewhere in between that, there's like a gentle curiosity. Okay, so what would it be like if? So there seems to be three little forces there at play. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think even the curiosity is can be driving, but it also can be something that makes you feel even more stuck sometimes. Where we say like, I could spend all day thinking about what would it be like if I made this career move, or if I, changed this thing up, or if I called this person that I haven't talked to in 10 years, or all this kind of stuff, right? We have these ideas of like what would happen, right? Humans daydream all the time. We think about like what could be, what could be, what could be. But at the same time, that can also be because we can, it's almost like the positivity compared to what we're currently doing makes us sad, is a very simple term. But like when we say like, oh, I could be doing this, but I'm not, that gap between like what you could be doing or the curiosity and all that kind of stuff, if you don't act on it, can also become more debilitating at the same time, because you're like, oh, I'm this piece of crap. I'm not doing those things. I could be doing those things, but I'm just kind of trudging through life, da, 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 da. And there's a very fine line between like curiosity and wanting to do something and going and doing it, and curiosity and wanting to do something and not doing it and becoming depressed because you can't do it, or you don't have enough insight, or you don't have enough motivation or coaching or skills or all these things, that we teach in therapy, but not everyone's privileged enough to go to therapy or has gone to therapy or has a good therapist, or coach or mentor or whatever, to learn how to do these things, right? Because there can be blocks that stop you from capitalizing on that curiosity. You could have ADHD, learning issues, depression, anxiety, all these different things that stop you, but you never got words for them. You never were taught what they were. You never were taught how to deal with them, all these different things. So there's a very fine line between like action and wanting action, but becoming sad, depressed, anxious, whatever, because you can't take that action or you're not taking that action. We're often two minds about things.
Yeah. Two minds. Yeah, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Two minds with that. There's that the logical mind, and then there's the illogical mind, the deep-seated stuff that
Yeah, the emotional one, right? Like it's that emotional mind. And to this day, I've been doing therapy for a little while now, and it still blows my mind that we can argue with ourselves, that we can debate ourselves about things. Like you're one person with one brain. What is that about? It's crazy that you can argue with yourself about things, that you can convince you can trick yourself into believing things that you know aren't true. Because we have those two minds. We have that logical, advanced mind, and then we have the caveman emotional mind. And those two things are trying to live in a world that isn't designed to cater to both of them. It's really designed to cater to neither of them. And we're just trying to navigate it. I firmly believe humans were never meant to be as smart as we are. It was a grave error to move out of the caves. We would have been much happier. And that's been shown even like in studies. It's true that that the more intelligent you are, the higher your IQ, the more likely you are to be depressed, and the more severe your depression is going to be, and the harder it is to treat. With intelligence comes negative things, and often it's because we can self-evaluate. We can see exactly what's going wrong, how we're doing, what we're doing, how it's counterproductive, da, 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 right? So in therapy, the goal is to kind of meld those two things together, become okay with how our brain works, all that sort of stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, the thing that came to my mind on that was in terms of like brain damage stuff, as a real type A Olympian guy here in the UK called Cracknell, James Cracknell. So he won Olympic golds in rowing, right? And he's a Iron Man triathlete, this sort of stuff, right? And he got knocked down by a truck in the States, and he knows he's got brain damage, but he still seems to trust what's going on in his brain. And 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 that's what came to my mind when you talked about intelligent people suffering more, because they believe their own stuff more, that the
Well,
brighter they are, the more.
the rationalization has become much, much more complex, right? So everyone rationalizes. We do it all the time. Little things here and there, but then as you get to kind of bigger rationalizations, more things about how we perceive the world, how we believe, all that kind of stuff. A rationalization is something that our brain does in order to convince us of something, to do something that we know that we don't want to do or shouldn't do. Sometimes that can be helpful, right? You can rationalize yourself into the All right, fine. I'll go take in the trash now instead of waiting until tomorrow because da, 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 right? But I don't want to do it, but I convince myself that I should do it, and then I do it. The flip side of that, which is where people use it even more often, is to convince themselves of doing things that they know they shouldn't be doing. Take addiction again, for example. We see here all the time. There's all sorts of rationalizations. Oh, I can manage. Oh, it's been fine. Oh, it wasn't that bad. Da, 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 right? But the more intelligent the client is, the harder it is to deconstruct those things. I'll take 50 average intelligence clients over five hyper intelligent clients, because it's just so much smoother and there's a lot less questioning and fighting and all that sort of stuff. But that is like the curse of humanity. Even the most average or below average intelligent person is still far and above, the cavemen. And so, we still have to struggle with those things as humans, when it comes to moving forward. And you're right, like our brains are our it is us, right? So it's very hard to separate ourselves from it, right? So even if you know that you have brain damage or something that is altering your reality, it is very difficult to ignore those things because the one source of truth that you've ever had in your life, which is your brain and your perception, is now telling you something different. Or is telling you whatever it's telling you. And so it's very difficult to ignore that. Oftentimes when you see like schizophrenia, that sort of thing, at least in the early stages, they know what they're saying is it doesn't logically track, but it's very hard to ignore, right? We only have one brain. We only have one source of reality. We only have one version of us. It's constantly changing, but we only have one source of ourselves, and that's our brain. I remember a few years ago, my daughter's now six, but when she was about three, we were reading books about the body and the nervous system and all that kind of stuff, and she was like, "Okay, so how does my brain know what to tell my body to do?" And it was like it was this whole. It took about a month, and she would ask new questions every day, and you could see the little wheels turning until she like finally understood it. She's like, "So I am my brain," and I was like, "Yes," and then she still had more questions after that. So it's a very weird concept, right? That's our one and only truth or truth detector, basically. And when that goes haywire, or when we push it in different directions, it can change a lot of things for us. It's very hard to separate ourselves from that.
So you talked about you talked about safety. Is there earlier on, and familiarity? Is there a link here? we're talking about the adoptees as adoptees. Is there something to do with adoption and adoptees not feeling safe and therefore craving more safety? So our propensity to crave safety is stronger, and that's why we get more addicted to something. Is that what this is about? I don't know. I've heard a lot
sure.
of talk about the fact that adoptees are overrepresented in addiction. Yeah.
So they are. Adoptees are about twice as likely to become addicted or become addicts as non-adoptees, which is a pretty huge number, right? Twice as likely. At least in the United States, it's kind of an old number from like 2014-ish. There's about a little under 2 million addicted adoptees in the United States, which is a pretty significant number as well. But yeah, you know, adoption is a trauma. Adoption is a trauma regardless of circumstance, right? So even if you have, there is no like perfect adoption, but let's say that you were born and your adoptive parents are right there, adopted you at birth, took you home. It was a transition, right? It was all right there. Everything was done. You knew from the time you could conceptualize that you were adopted, all that sort of stuff, right? That is still a trauma, right? That is still a trauma. There is a spectrum of trauma, right? But it's all subjective, right? It's that trauma is going to be different than someone who ended up in foster care for a couple of years and then was adopted, or, you know, live with bio family, but then had to be adopted. You know, there's all these different unique circumstances around each adoptee, but adoption is a trauma in and of itself. That's the starting point, because there is a separation there. By default, there is a separation. There is a break in, you know, call it chemical, you can call it the oxytocin connection, you can call it whatever, but there's a break. And that break is a trauma. What you do with it or how it affects you varies wildly from person to person. But the idea of like seeking safety because of it, that becomes something tricky, right? Because a lot of adoptees learn that attachments are not safe. They're not stable, right? Because we have that initial belief that our first attachment didn't stick around. So the idea that attachments aren't safe, and not every adoptee has this, but a majority, at least the ones that I've worked with over the years, have this underlying belief that they don't really understand, but they have it, that attachments aren't safe. However, it is one of the most basic human needs to have attachment, right? We need it just as much as we need food and water. We don't develop properly without it. All these different terrible things happen if we don't have proper attachment or any attachment at all. And so, you know, as we do this and as we try and seek out safety in others, which is our basic way of, as humans, of seeking safety, is to get outside of our heads by connecting with other people. And we find ourselves unable to do that or too afraid to do that on a deeper level. We don't have the same ability for safety as other people do, as non-adoptees do initially, right? That's what's important. It's not something that's permanent. You can learn how to, you can develop an ability to have healthy, full attachments to other people. Adoptees are not permanently damaged in this aspect. You know, there's a lot of talk in the world. There's a lot of old research that says like, yeah, maybe they are, but you are not. You are not unable. You are not permanently damaged in a way that you cannot connect to another human person in a real healthy way. But yes, there is that seeking safety piece. Is that the factor that impacts the increased addiction in adoptees? Maybe. That's the answer that that's the only answer we can get with adoptees and addiction, is maybe or possibly, right? They've done huge studies, like 18,000 person studies, to see what would influence the increase in addiction in adoptees. And they looked at everything they could think of and they got nothing. There was just no one factor that stood out more than the others, right? So it could be biological parents were addicts, so you have the genetic predisposition to be an addict, right? It could be age of adoption, SES status. You know, there's a million, they studied like 100 different factors and not one stood out enough, which I think is kind of beautiful in its own way, right? Adoptees are unique each time. There's some grand themes, right? But they're unique each time. And so the story is going to be different each time. So we kind of have to accept the fact that, like, yes, they are twice as likely. Let's see how we can help them. And that's kind of what I've focused on is like, cool, we know they exist. What can we do about it?
So we are talking about statistics here, and yeah, we are just you are one person, I am one person. So we're the strange thing was, I'm trying to come up with a better aside to the a better story about this. I can't do it, but I'm going to relate this to a business guy, a guy, sort of a friend of mine. He was considering whether he should open a new kitchen showroom, right? And he's hearing that the economy is going to go bad, and therefore, should he or shouldn't he do it? And it's like you can just overthink that. And when I we were in a like a peer-to-peer coaching group, right? Mentoring group. And I said to him, well, what's your conversion rate at the moment between the number of people that come to your showroom to look at buying a kitchen and how many people buy a kitchen from you? And he was going, well, I don't know. I said, well, that's the place to start. Focus your effort on what you can control rather than going into some massive overthinking about the statistic about the the statistical probability of whether things are going to work out. It's like we're just one person, and when you're looking at the statistics, you're talking about, as you said, 18 thousands of people. So it there is no yes or no's. It's about us and what we do here right in the moment. We don't need to worry about what probabilities are or what the population as a whole is going to be. It's about us, right? And
A
does that
100%. Yeah, and there's a quote that I heard a long time ago, and I have no idea where it's from. But it was talking about statistics, right? And it said that you can predict what the average man can do, but rarely does a man act in an average way. So we can have these broad strokes, but until I sit in a room with a client, until we kind of parse out that story or see how they feel or that sort of thing, right? Like, yes, I have my broad strokes, I have my evidence-based interventions and all this kind of stuff that I've built up over the years. But that only matters so much until you start talking to the person and see how it affects them. And then you kind of feel it out from there and do all the mixing and everything after that. So yes, like we know they exist, but the practicality of how to treat them is or what impacts the severity of their presentation, all that kind of stuff. When I did my own research on what I thought might impact the severity, I got pretty much nothing. What I was looking at the relationship to biological parents or the idea of them, and the answer was like, who knows? It just kind of varies. It varies widely. And again, that's what working with adoptees is like. That's what it is. Like we are adoption is a piece, sometimes a very important piece, sometimes not a very important piece, but it is a piece of our story. But humans are infinitely varied and always changing, right? Every second of the day, we're changing in little tiny itty bitty microscopic ways, in our psyche. I'm not talking about biologically, but also that. And so to try and pinpoint that is not going to be possible, right? All we can do is broad stroke. That's why I love psychology so much, is that we're not this like hard science of like physics. If you drop a pencil, it's going to fall the same way in the same rate every time. Psychology is different. We get the broad strokes, but then there's the art to it. There's the art of managing or helping or conversing or learning about other people. That's personally what keeps me engaged, and that's what I love the most. But it's kind of indicative of the process overall. And when we talk about adoptees, there's even more variance there.
Interestingly, I did a course in psychology at university, and I didn't fall in love with it like you did, right? I found it really frustrating, which is an interesting way to look at it, So the how we change things, I talked about the we talked about the time thing. And society says, generally, society says change is hard, change takes a long time. And it, I think that that, I was going to mention this word earlier on to you, this phrase, confirmation bias. So, can you give us, I mean, I've got a kind of a view on what that is, but what's confirmation bias? You heard
So
that?
confirmation bias is when you basically see what you're looking for. So if you go out, thinking that something's going to be the way that it's going to be, you're most likely going to see it as that way. So if you go to a party and you've never met any of the people there before, and you're like, oh, these people suck and they're going to be rude and all that kind of stuff. When you walk into the party, you're more likely to see or pick out the specific rude or this or overestimate or over exaggerate, the different characteristics because you went in with that idea. That kind of goes back to like the fear around change, right? We want to be able to predict things. It's a safety mechanism. We want to be able to know what's going to happen next. That's impossible. We can't know what's going to happen next, so we try and do our best to predict what's going to happen next, but that often puts us in a trap of only experiencing what we think is going to happen because we put so much effort into thinking about what's going to happen next. So we want to just kind of live in that, and then it kind of helps us maintain the status quo too. That's part of where, I do a lot of my work is in like authenticity. And a lot of change becomes a lot easier when you can become more authentic. But the real trick, and this is the greatest secret that I have, for change or for feeling more okay with yourself, is that authenticity isn't about finding yourself. I think everything that says like go find who you are, and I don't want to piss anybody off with this, but like finding yourself is such a toxic concept. Because, like I said, we're always evolving, we're always changing. So unless you were to lock yourself in a sensory deprivation tank for the rest of your life, you're going to experience things that's always changing you. So that definition is always going to change, and you can't define yourself anyways. But the real trick, and here's the secret, the real trick to being authentic is finding out who you're not. Take that away, and all that's left is you. Then you don't have to worry about defining yourself. Just worry about who you're not. If you sit around and think about it long enough and experience things and keep track of yourself, you know who you're not, and you take that away, all that's left is you. And when all that's left is you and your authenticity, you're able to receive those new experiences. That confirmation bias goes way down. It's never going to go away totally, right? We're still human. But it goes way down. You're just able to kind of be in the moment. That's the definition of authenticity, is presence in the here and now. So being able to be in the moment, to be engaged, and to experience things as they are. And have an understanding of where like you end and the world and the game and the social experience begins. That's like the greatest thing, right? Having that authenticity. But that's the trick. Figure out who you're not and take that away.
Okay, so we're in my favorite subject here, the who we are not, who we are, right? So I've got a take on this, and essentially the take is that we are not our trauma. So if you if the metaphor I often use with this is that have you seen me doing this with the diamond in the fist?
No.
No. So this won't work on a podcast, listeners. It won't work anymore when I did it last time, right? But imagine a clenched fist, and the clenched fist is a metaphor for the trauma that we've been through, and as Brett's talked about. Oh yeah, I've you know when I was saying Brett or Bet, I've got my wife's auntie is called Aunt Bet. I was wondering why am I, what's going on in my head, Bet or Brett? I know that I'm talking to Brett. Brett looks
Well,
very
that,
different.
Freud would say you very much want me to be your aunt. So,
Oh, okay,
there's that.
right. That's a rabbit hole. Let's not go down Freud's rabbit hole. So, the fist is the metaphor for the trauma. And then and I hold that up to the screen. That's what I'm holding up to the screen. And inside that fist is the diamond. I've got like a glass diamond here that I got off Amazon for like $9, 6 quid or something like that. So the glass diamond represents the truth of who we are, and the trauma represents who we are not. So we are not our trauma. So rooting around in the trauma, we're not going to find, well, yeah, we are going to, if we root around in the trauma, yeah, we are going to, the trick is to find the identity, who we are underneath that trauma. So we're not our trauma. So, you know, what we are not our trauma. We are not our confirmation bias. We are not our thoughts, our feelings. We're not our beliefs. We're not our self-limiting beliefs. We're the thing that's left after all those have been put to one side. Now, that's 14 years of study and curiosity summed up in a kind of a neat, hopefully a neatish concept that I spent 2 minutes describing. But to me, it's not, that's not just a theoretical idea in my head. That's my belief in my bones, right? So it's not even like a feeling in my heart. It's a belief in my bones. It's like an embodied thing. So what that's my take on who we are not. What's your take on this from something that from a guy who
Well, and
clearly knows far more about this stuff than me?
well, I mean, I love that metaphor, and I think it's and I feel the same way about like when I talk about authenticity. It's something that I had to come to really believe for myself and understand, and that's why I believe it so strongly, is I feel it in my bones too. You know, it's we are not any one thing. We are never just something, right? When I talk about authenticity, right, like I can, or like who am I, right? I can give all these answers. I'm a father, a therapist, a director of this, I'm a guy on Zoom talking to someone across the pond, also on Zoom. You know, those are all things which are true. They're not wrong, but they're not who I am. I could spend the rest of my life writing a list of all the labels that I have for myself, and none of those things, that list will never encompass the experience of being me, or the way other people experience me, or the way that I experience the world. You know, all those sort of stuff, right? If we look on the scientific side of things, depends on what study you ask, but scientists estimate that we experience between 4 to 400 billion bits of information per second, right? We filter out 99.99999% of those, right? But we are still processing through and filtering through, let's go on the low end, 4 billion bits of information per second, right? So we are constantly being impacted by the information we are receiving. Like I said, in small ways, usually, sometimes in big ways, depending on what it is. But to say that I am this one thing, that might be true for the 1 second where you say it, but it's going to change the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, all the seconds that make up your life. So to say that you are any one thing, or even a multitude of things, is always going to be inaccurate. You can't be a list of things. You can only be that diamond in your fist, right? And even that diamond is indescribable. But you know, there's always going to be that shiny content self underneath it all, and it's there. A lot of clients are like, "Well, what if I take away all these things and there's nothing there, or I don't like what's down there?" Well, that's not possible. One, there is something there. You spent your whole life building it, you just don't know it. And two, you're not going to not like it because it's you. By definition, you can't dislike it. And if you do, that means you're not being authentic. It can be scary. That's different than not liking it. But you know, it's as we strip away all those things, we strip away the meaning behind those labels, or we get to choose, not strip, choose is a better term. We get to choose how much we want all these things to impact us, or how we want to respond, or how we want to experience all these things. That's kind of where like the real authenticity in the who we are not comes from. And it becomes a more automatic process the more you practice it, which is the most important once you kind of feel that. And I think a lot of the who we are or who we're not comes from like this pursuit of happiness idea, right? Everybody wants to be happy, sure. And we're taught, I think especially in America, we're taught like this pursuit of it's in the thing. It's written in ink, the pursuit of happiness. And we should always have these things, and you're gonna find it one day, and all that kind of stuff. I personally think like that happiness thing is not overrated, but it's like toxically unattainable at all times. You can definitely have times where you're happy, that's great, but I think being content is severely underrated. To be able to be content and be okay in any given moment, and then kind of ride whatever comes after that. That's what authenticity is about, is the ability to be content in those moments. So finding out who you're not, taking that away, allowing yourself to be content and not worry about the things that you are or are not, right? Those problematic shoulds. I should be this, I should be that, I shouldn't be this, I shouldn't be that. That's kind of where that diamond comes from.
Have you heard the truth that there is no one Facebook? Have you heard that?
No one on Facebook.
There is no one Facebook. So we it's a metaphor. You said there's no one of us because we're constantly changing, the 4 billion data bits and all that sort of stuff. The metaphor that came to my mind, there is no one Facebook. So at any one time, I don't know how many probably Facebook's got like 100,000 people working for it. I don't know, but their techies are at any one time running like, I don't know, 20,000, 200,000, 5 million. They're running 1,000,001 experiments to see how they can adjust the algorithm, how that tracks for their user retention, how that tracks for their money, because now they're floated on a stock exchange, so all they want is higher profit. So the whole thing is about more ad views, more people looking at more pages, so that they can sell them more adverts, so that they can get this thing right. So there isn't any one Facebook because it's not a static thing. I'm looking at two things here. I'm looking at a glass that had some water in, and I'm looking at a mug I had some tea in, right? That mug doesn't change, but we change all the time on your basis of what you're saying, and I've never heard of it expressed that way before, and I think it's beautiful and powerful. And Facebook, there's no one Facebook. Facebook is changing all the time. So we can't pin ourselves down. Like the pursuit of who we are is gonna leave us, well, it's gonna wrap us around the twist, aren't we? We're gonna wrap around the axle because it's in a constant state of flux, to use your.
And even to tie it back to like the perception piece, right? Like no two people perceive things in the exact same way. Even if for any one event that involves two people or more, there's more than one truth about that event. It's not the same every time. There's even evidence that shows that we perceive people to be taller or shorter than they are. I think it's like up to plus or minus 2 inches based on how much social power we feel they have. So if you're in a room with someone who's the exact same height as you, and you feel like, and it's like the president or whatever, you're going to perceive them as being taller than they actually are, if you were to draw it out, right? So our perception, things that we hold as absolutes, like someone is only exactly this amount of inches tall, there's that doesn't even hold true in our perception of the way we see the world. So the way that we perceive things from person to person varies wildly as well, and it's supposed to. Even that mug, if I was looking at the same mug of tea on your desk, you would see it differently than I would because you have a history with that mug. You know, you have all these things that impact the way that you see it and handle it and hold it and all this kind of stuff, right? I've never seen it before in my life. So we would notice different things about it. We would perceive it in a different way. So that's always, that perception is always impacted by our experiences in the world as well.
I want to go to the time issue on change, and you know that I was talking earlier on about society tells us that change takes time. Society tells us that change is hard. So what doesn't that make the whole thing harder? The fact that we're culturally conditioned to believe this stuff is hard?
You know, I think it's I can't speak for like UK culture, but at least in American culture, we're taught that, you know, change is, you should always pick yourself up by your bootstraps and push forward and more, 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 and capitalism and whatever. Which ironically, the pick yourself up by your bootstraps saying was originally intended to talk about like dumb people who are trying to get something impossible because you can't literally pick yourself up by your bootstraps because they're on your feet. So, but we, especially in American English, like to take sayings that used to mean something stupid and try and make them seem like something noble. But that's one of them. Anyways, you know, we're taught that like, yes, it's hard, but that's what makes it worth it. Which is true to a degree, right? If something is super easy and like free, it loses value, right? But when you kind of hit that authenticity point, you don't really care about how much effort it is or that sort of thing. It just becomes like this fluid process and you make the change because you want to make the change. And that is part of it, right? Separating yourself from the problematic shoulds of society, which say this should be hard, or you should always do this, or you should always have A's, or you should always be first, or you know, all this kind of stuff. When you separate yourself from that and do things because authentically you want to do them, and it's separate from what you feel like you've been told or you've told yourself that you should or shouldn't be or do or all that kind of stuff, that's where the change becomes a lot more fluid. That's where it becomes more in real time. That's when you're acting out of a place of who you are, which I still don't like that term, but who you are, as opposed to I'm trying to meet this expectation, I'm trying to meet this like keeping up with the Joneses sort of thing.
What are the biggest, as you've been on your journey so far, what have been the biggest things that have helped you change?
Honestly, just being content with being content, that was the biggest thing for me. I spent a lot of my life, I still have anxiety, but you know, with a lot worse anxiety, just a lot of questioning and predicting and worrying and shoulds and all this kind of stuff, and thinking that there was supposed to be some like cloud parting, I'm happy now moment where I'm just like skipping on rainbows for the rest of my life. That's not real. Being content with being content and being okay with like saying, yeah, I'm content. I can still want more, but I can also be content with where I am. My contentment is not based on me having more things or being more this or being more that. I'm doing those things because I want to do them, not because I feel like I have to do them or I should do them. At least for me, that being content with being content was one of the biggest like changes for me. And it kind of just came across like, as I was learning about this, learning about myself and how can I manage this, it wasn't like a big cloud parting moment. It was sort of like passively, I just kind of came to this idea until it clicked. And I can't tell you when it clicked. It just did. But it took a lot of time, a lot of internal dismantling to get to that point of being okay with being okay. And then from there, you can kind of fine tune it, right? You can take away the things that are inauthentic. You can catch yourself and be more aware when you're acting under certain systems. And sometimes you act under certain systems because you want to, right? That's fine. But you know, that being content with being content piece was the biggest change for me.
Interesting. So one of my mentors used to say that happiness and sadness are merely the high and low tides of a big sea of and a big sea called contentment.
Very much so. Perfect.
And he works with his he works with his partner, who I name check quite a lot, on the podcast, Elizabeth Ivory. And so she's mentored me and coached me, counseled me, therapized me, whatever, for years. And the stuff I got with from her was, if we're okay with not feeling okay. To be, so there's a difference. Well, being okay with not feeling okay. Because what we resist persists, right? So I was thinking about that as you talked about anxiety. You have less anxiety than you used to do. And the first thing that came to me was maybe Brett's not fighting his anxiety like he used to do. So on the one hand, you've got this anxiety, and all you want to do is to be happy, right? So you've got anxieties in the way of your happiness. So somehow you've got to break through your anxiety to the other side, and then there's going to be this cloud parting moment, and you're going to find happiness. So the anxiety becomes a bigger and bigger thing, until the realization kind of melts it, and you stop
Yeah,
resisting.
and every emotion works that way. I firmly believe, and it goes back to that safety piece, right? Anxiety is a safety-seeking emotion. It's trying to predict the future. It knows that it can't, and activates your fight or flight system, just like if you were facing down a saber-toothed tiger, with a wooden spear. And it activates you in the same way. Even depression, in its own twisted way, is trying to keep you safe. Depression puts, the opposite of rose-colored glasses. Puts, I use a more crude term. Let's call them poop-colored glasses on your eyes. And it makes you believe that everything has, is, and forever will be crappy. Because if you only drop a little bit when something bad happens, because you already believe it's going to happen. You depression tells you that's going to hurt less than if you're doing well and then something bad happens. So it's trying to keep you from less hurt by kind of keeping you in hurt at a moderate level or a severe level all the time. Obviously it's misfiring and that's not useful. But all these emotions are trying to keep us safe, which goes to your point. When you ignore them or tell them they're invalid or try and push them away, they're going to kick and scream until you pay attention to them, because again, our strongest driving force is to keep ourselves safe. So if your brain feels like you're ignoring the things that are going to keep you safe, it's going to scream its head off until you pay attention to it. That's one of the biggest things that I've tried, and we'll see if it works. Try to teach my daughter when she was like 2, and still is, this is what anxiety is. This is how you talk to it. Here's how you can manage it. Here's how to show it respect, but you also don't have to do what it says. You can respect it, honor it, but you don't have to listen to it. And that is what will make it calmer and go away and those sort of things. And so even now, it's been a couple of years now, and she's kind of like annoyed whenever I bring it up. She's like, yeah, I know. I talk to it and I say thank you, and then I go and do it, but I don't want to do what you say. Like she'll just like fire it off at me. But she's doing it in her head, which has helped a lot because she has anxiety. I have it, my wife has it, she's screwed, she's got our brains. So I was trying to get in there early to try and teach that. But we need to respect the emotions that we have, but respect doesn't mean listening to them. It doesn't mean doing what they say. We need to hear them and make them feel heard. And if you can make them feel heard when they're at a 2 as opposed to an 11, they won't feel the need to go to an 11 to scream until you pay attention to it. Which usually when it's up that high, it means you're being debilitated, right? You didn't go do the thing because your anxiety was so high. You didn't get out of bed because your depression was so high. All that sort of stuff. There's like chemical factors and all that sort of stuff too. But in general, right, if we can respect those emotions and respect their purpose, but not do what they say or choose whether or not we want to do what they say, that's where you can kind of get some more freedom from them and move yourself more towards that contentment. And that's exactly, you're right. You're saying that's what I did, and that is what I did. When I'm anxious, I recognize it as my anxiety. I know myself well enough now. I've opened myself up to that where I can tell when I'm getting more anxious. I have things that are my signs before I even recognize it in my brain that I'm starting to get more anxious because of this, that, or the other. And so, to know that, respect it, and then know what to do about it, is a huge gift.
So we're back to the addiction thing because you're talking about not acting on the feeling, not fighting the feeling, not acting on the feeling, not acting on the thought. Whereas what I'm guessing that when we do act on it, that's when we're going down the path to we're seeking safety, we're having that drink, we and then we're having the next one and the next one. That is that what this is all about?
To a certain degree, yeah. There's addictions a symptom. It's a symptom of greater mental health struggles. And there isn't necessarily just one thing, right? But in general, and this is something that I feel is really important to understand and kind of fights the stigma around addiction is people aren't addicts because they're stupid. They're not addicts because they don't understand that it's bad. They're addicts because they have a problem that they feel is impossible to fix, and the only escape they can have is through substances. They found a way to temporarily treat whatever it is that's plaguing them. Let's say it's anxiety, right? They have such severe anxiety that badgers them day and night, and the only reprieve they can have from it is to get high or get drunk or whatever. There's a lot of new therapy that says, like, congratulations, you figured something out. You found a way to help yourself. Good job. Now let's find a better way to do it. And I agree with that, right? Addiction is a disease of escapism. If we're not taught how to identify and deal with our emotions, we're going to find our own ways to do it. And there's nothing as immediately effective as getting high. There's no therapy that I can do that will be as instantaneous as shooting up or taking Xanax or getting a drink or whatever, right? It has very short-term effects and very long-term damages, but it is very quickly effective in that moment. And so it's important to understand that they're not doing it because they're trying to hurt you or because they're stupid and they don't know that it's bad for them, or all that sort of stuff. It's because they're hurting, right? And it's different. There's been like getting drunk, and partying with your friends or whatever, and it becoming an everyday occurrence. There's a fine line between addiction and, recreational use. But when it becomes that addiction piece, right? When the continued use despite the negative consequences starts to happen, there's something else going on. It's not just addiction, right? That's not how it works.
Yeah. The thing that popped into my head, I love that addiction is a symptom. I think that's so bang on the money. And the escapism piece as well, I think is particularly useful. And I was thinking about, more how society and cultures and I think they're largely this, from what I can gather, that it's similar in the UK and the US. In the Western world, probably same in Canada as well. We've got there's these things like you heard this thing retail therapy, retail therapy. It's like it works. Yeah, it works until you get your credit card bill, doesn't it? I mean,
Very much so. And
but the long term.
we call them cross addictions, right? It's not just relegated to drinking or smoking, right? We have sex and porn addiction. We have gambling. We have internet video games. We have, all these different. Anything that takes you out of your reality for whatever period of time, you can become addicted to.
Yeah. So I'm conscious of time. Is there anything else? As usual, listeners, check out the show notes for links to see what Brett's doing and connect with him on the socials and stuff. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we bring it in?
I mean, the only thing is, one, again, I really appreciate you having me on. I mean, this isn't talked about enough, and only recently have I been able to expand the platform to be able to talk about this. So, I really appreciate you seeking me out and inviting me on. that's got me excited for the future of how we can help. But in general, for anybody that's listening to this that feels like they are struggling, right? Like, go ask for help. Go find a therapist. If you don't like that therapist, find a different therapist. Therapists are human, just like you. So you may not get along with the first one. It doesn't mean that therapy doesn't work for you. It means that therapist doesn't work for you. Shop around, keep going. Any therapist worth their salt will completely understand and say, here's a list of referrals, and God bless. I hope you figure it out with the absolute intent that they want you to figure it out. That's what we're supposed to do. If they don't, it may not be the right person for you. But therapy, there's a lot of stigma around it. There's a lot of stigma around addiction. There's a lot of stigma around taking care of yourself. But please take care of yourselves. That's what this is for. That's what, is going to help you move forward from this. And you are not just the one thing. You are not the trauma. You are not your adoption. You are not this. You are not that. You can choose what things you want to be part of. So as always, I appreciate you putting my info in the notes. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm always happy to direct, consult, coach, help, whatever I can do to point you in the right direction or help you myself. I'm always open to doing that and talking to other professionals, and coaching and training and da 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 da. Like, I want this out there. So I am always happy to help, and I'm always happy to point people in the right direction because I get it. I don't get your exact story, but there is help and there is a way to move forward.
Good on you. Thanks a lot, Brett. And we will speak to you very soon, listeners. Thanks for listening. Trana, bye-bye.